Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host, Rajni Gamage, a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute. In 2024, South Asia is expected to be the center of several political, economic, and social developments. Several countries in the region have had elections or have elections coming up, and the political and social mobilization that comes with that has already begun. In addition, there are several economic stresses driven by internal and external forces. Since the pandemic, since 2020, and seen in issues of debt sustainability and growing socioeconomic inequality, in this context, cities, which have been subject to rapid transformation in the face of decades of development projects, are an important site of observation in how these developments play out. To understand the transformation of cities and urbanization in South Asia, I am joined by Professor Nihal Pereira, Emeritus Professor of Ball State University in the USA. He is the author of several volumes, including Decolonizing Ceylon, Colonialism, Nationalism, and the Politics of Space in Sri Lanka, and a co-edited volume, Transforming Asian Cities, Intellectual Impasse, Asianizing Space, and Emerging Translocalities. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
So to start off, politics and society in many South Asian states still have very deep and complex links with their colonial and pre-colonial histories. So could you share some insights into how the history of South Asian countries, the ones you study more closely, for example, have shaped urbanization processes?
Yeah, so thank you for the question. I will try to be very brief because I have written in these books and we have very limited time. I think what the urbanization, my study, because I like to study something concrete, because people talk about globalization, neoliberalism, nobody can catch any of these things, right? So when I study the production of Ceylon or Sri Lanka in regard to space, it occurred to me, I mean, there are four things that are very clear to me. One is Colombo never evolved from the land which the Sri Lankan people call Sri Lanka. It was created as a part of the Indian Ocean urban system that was created by the Portuguese first, right? And Colombo was an outpost. So it was a Portuguese city. How do I know? Because its structures are churches, a fort, a feitoria, and so on. None of these things existed in capital cities of the local people, if we can do that. And then secondly, so it was a part of something that was connected to a metropole, first Lisbon, Amsterdam, and then London. Then Ceylon was produced from Colombo. It was British after 1815, after the defeating of the central kingdom of Kandivudrat, which is called Kandy. They subdivided the island into provinces and districts. Provinces are administrative provinces. Districts are revenue districts. And they connected through a communication system to Colombo. It's not connecting them to Colombo. It's subjecting them to Colombo. Basically, that was the idea, right? So that was how it was produced, and it was a very different place than anything that the Sri Lankan people call that existed previously, because this has a boundary. On the other side of the boundary, there's another state, and old kingdoms on this island did not have boundaries; they had frontiers for the large part. Number three, British also built an economy in here, which was coffee plantations first and then tea plantations, that was compatible with the European world economy. So they incorporated this into that, making Colombo the node, central node, between the world economy and the local economy. And I have very clearly shown how the capitalists, the capital, the labor, the land, and everything was produced, including the crop. Right, so I'm not going to go into that in detail. Number five is they not only built this, they also taught the local people to understand and appreciate and work within this. So that is the epistemological side, which possibly we will come back again. So therefore, the locals actually, in a sense, what independence means for me is that it's the brown people taking over what the white people did. So actually, the Ceylon did not have a state. Neither did India or Malaysia or anything like that. They had a colonial administration. So the colonial administration is adopted as the nation state of the local people, right? And then that is why none of these provinces and district structure nor the infrastructure has been ever changed. Everybody's asking, why are we still having this colonial infrastructure and so on? I think that's what it is. It's stuck, yeah.
Right. I think that's a very good kind of place to move on to my second question, as you describe Sri Lanka's legacy, colonial legacies, and how that continues into the reproduction of the present urban spaces that we see. So I would like to ask your opinion on what you think of this concept of a post-colonial city. How has space maybe been negotiated? Do we see hierarchies that were present during the colonial time reproduced in the current context, or do they manifest in different ways?
So after independence, it's really interesting to see that the colonial, the center of Colombo, which was a fort, was the Colombo fort was the, because there was a fort, now there is no walls, but that was the administrative capital. It continued as the capital until 1982, until the parliament was shifted, not too far, just outside of the boundary of Colombo, which is actually a little bit of a joke, I think, from a spatial standpoint, right? And then much of the administrative buildings still existed there. So I think they were comfortable. This includes the conservatives as well as the radicals, because I think radicalism also comes from Europe at the end of the day. So it is in there. So they all believe in, say, democracy and things like that. They never questioned what is democracy. How do we even talk about democracy? I wouldn't even ask what is democracy. I would ask, how do people make decisions? Because democracy is one way of making decisions by the Europeans, right? So rather than just accepting something that somebody else is doing, we can go back to the roots of something and then ask, What is the issue? However, during the so-called era of globalization, the Sri Lankan government of 1977 decided to move the capital to Kote, as I said earlier, and they readjusted. They wanted to transform the Colombo Fort area into a central business district of the global kind. So I think it was a very interesting strategy. I haven't seen this in many other places. They moved, so they did not allow any local architect to design this. It's a Singaporean, so they wanted to become a Singapore, and then Singaporean architects designed the tallest building there and so on. It was a model which didn't take off for a long time. Yet they moved the parliament, which the design of which was given to the so-called leading Sri Lankan architect, and it was built in somewhat of a Sri Lankan style, right? So that gives a national representation. So there was a very interesting split between those. But now I think it has gone beyond that, you know, because now they are refurbishing colonial buildings, you know, to bring back to the market and so on. The city, you know, I don't think you asked, so I'll stop here. We have come to a point where Colombo is pretty much a kleptocratic city.
I think that's really fascinating how you mentioned that even as the state in its urban design develops or designs the city in a way that appeals to a global capital, global market, while at the same time retaining some degree of so-called national authenticity. I think that's a very interesting dynamic. And before I move on to my next question, I think I'd be interested to know what you mean by a kleptocratic city.
I think Sri Lanka right currently has I have written about this, but I have not published yet. It's in the process. I believe the system, if there is a system, in Sri Lanka, is a kleptocratic system. It's a very hard thing to prove, you know, like from traditional academic ways, because nobody's kind of like nobody tells how they earn money in Sri Lanka, right? I mean, because those days we used to have like data, right? I mean, people now they don't, and they're asking, why are you calling us thieves and stealing, and I'm not calling that because I don't know, but I know some people became rich. I mean, one person became rich, you know, like he became the president, and by the end of the term, he became the richest person. And if you can become the richest person if you don't have, like, I mean, like Jeff Bezos or something, somebody like that, right? So there should be some other income that they are not revealing. So I don't know. So this income should be coming from another place, right? Wherever. So when I look at it from an academic standpoint, I see that the state has been taken over by the government. Now, state and government are two separate institutions. State is elected. Government is kind of like, you know, through skills and, you know, professions and so on. So when I was a kid, you know, the permanent secretary used to advise the minister. Now, no, the minister will tell the permanent secretary what to do. So it has become something very different. So the politicians, they are actually together. Because, you know, like earlier, one party said, you know, like, if we come to power, we will send these guys to jail. But nothing happens because they file cases and they withdraw, whatever. Nothing has happened. Eventually, what I'm thinking, my hypothesis was proved when they got the opponent to become the president of the Rajapaksa regime. Right. So they have been together. I mean, I don't know who steals and who doesn't steal, but the thing is, there's a lot of money that's being, because the Auditor General has been saying, you know, like, there's ill management of money. I mean, so none of these people want to say, as I'm hesitating to say, there was some very big malpractices are going on. So what I'm saying is kind of like the state is being used to earn money. Basically, by whom? By the politicians who have actually taken over the state, right? So it is a very different system than capitalism. In capitalism, the capitalists would invest and exploit labor. So there's production process and so on. I mean, I don't see, I mean, there, of course, people can say there's production, there's trade unions. Of course, all these things are there. But the thing is, the main system doesn't function like that. So that is the, and what happens to the city is, so the city is transformed into a space of consumption, right? And they are bringing in all the colonial structures back into play, and actually they are for very rich people, right? I mean, and tourists. And there is a kind of like a group, I don't want to call a mafia or something, but there's a group that runs all these things, these businesses. But these businesses are not capitalist enterprises in the Marxian sense, right? Yeah.
Well, I think these are topics that are very pertinent, especially in the aftermath of the Aragalaya, where a lot of these topics of public mismanagement of funds, corruption, were very central to the people's protests, and also kind of, I think, harking back to what you raised earlier on during this chat, which is that the city has historically been a site of accumulating capital that has been obtained through extraction, through an extraction right. form of economy. And to see that reproduced in the current context, as you say, maybe at a different, I would argue, at a different stage of capitalist growth. So, I mean,
if
yes.
Like so.
and the kind of elite bargaining and elite politics at the political level, at the business level, at all these different levels. I think that's a very interesting point you raise. Perhaps I will move on to a very related question. As I mentioned, the 2022 People's Protests, which captured, I think, a lot of regional and international attention. In your observation of how the People's Protests manifested in Goldface Green in Colombo, how were you able to make sense of how space was negotiated by different groups of people who congregated at this space? And are there any insights that you have from these observations for the current state of politics in Sri Lanka?
Yeah, I mean, I can't, as I was kind of like somewhat reacting about capitalism, you know, like as you said. I usually don't look at from largest, because I'm not insecure not having a larger concept to understand. Because I would very much, I think in Asia, in transforming Asian cities, you know, you had a question you may not have time to ask, but I would like to understand Asian cities and Asia from Asia, not from outside, right? So in regard to the Aragale or the uprise, what happened was, if I may be brief, you know, like, I mean, I've written a chapter that will come out. People eventually, if I may call it, quote unquote people, they occupied the agitation site, which was designated by the president, right? I mean, this is a part of Goldface, it's not Goldface. And so many agitations happened there, but this time it was overwhelmed and it was occupied. First with two tents, and then it became this occupied site. So in a sense, I can say I'm relating to a lot of international events like the Occupy movement and so on, but I don't think anybody planned anything here. You know, there was no pre-planned thing, right? But then once they occupied this land, the state or the government, there's no state in that separate sense actually, the government opted to fight, you know, take it back. Now, government has options, I think, you know, in my research. It can just, like in the earlier times, it can just let people, okay, come here 5 days, 10 days, 15 days, you will go away. No, government decided to fight back. So I think when you fight back for that, then you are you are the loser, right? I mean, you can win it, but you are fighting back. So in a sense, the Aragale won that. It was their space. So the streets and occupy spaces, they all became their space, right? And then what happened was, eventually, people were coming in, you know, in waves. At one point, they even took over the prime minister's residence and the president's residence and everything. Unfortunately, a lot of people talk an old language, general strike, hartal. That's old, because those were led by the Sama Samaja Party and the old, you know, the Marxist parties. We don't have any at this time, so they would have actually led to something. You know, like, okay, we have occupied everything, we are going to form a temporary government. We're going to hold elections ourselves, or we are going to have a discussion about what should transportation be, what should education be. You know, there were lots of options that the political parties involved did not see or did not want to see. So people, for the first time in Sri Lankan history, people went beyond the political parties. And then they were turned into jokes. The media was telling, you know, these guys were swimming in the president's swimming pool and so on and so on. Now you can see, in a sense, people won, yet at the same time they lost, right, in a sense. But then the prime minister left on April, May the 9th, and president fled the country July the 9th. And then they were trying to kind of like elect a president in the parliament. And then the JVP, which the only party other than those main parties has any elect seats, and were even partially or slightly represented, said, we are going to contest the elections. I think that's when the Aragale was lost. I think they did not want the Aragale to win the way they made their own statements. So the thing is, they found an option where they have three seats out of 225. They can get three seats. That doesn't mean anything to a people's political party. Or they can win using the government's votes, and then they can't do anything, right? I mean, they will have to continue, which Ranil is doing right now, right? So they I don't know whether they fell into a trap or they thought something big. So spatially speaking, people brought the Aragale to the Aragale site and the streets, which was their domain. That was their space. They won it. And then they extended it to the presidents and those residences. And then the JVP brought it back to parliament, which nobody would have expected, and The Aragale died in an unfamiliar place, which is the parliament. Parliament was never a part of the Aragale, and JVP was very successful taking it to the parliament.
Perhaps I will ask a closing question in line with some of these very interesting thread that I've maybe been noticing in your discourse. Even as you mentioned before that you would rather not be tied to a large theoretical framework. And also, I found it very interesting your remark, which was that in searching for solutions to the social problems that we face, social and political problems we face in our societies, often we go back to frameworks and concepts that were conceptualized perhaps in very different periods and might not be as transformative or relevant to the current context. So just in closing, in some of your work on Asian cities, so even beyond Sri Lanka, you have mentioned how there's an epistemic impasse in reading Asian urban transformations, and this being one of the biggest challenges. So could you briefly elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in asking this big question. Asia is going to lead the world. Asia is transforming. This was like that for a couple of decades, right? Or a few decades. So I was interested rather than, you know, like I've studied the world system and so on, but that's not what I'm interested in. I was interested in asking what does the urban show in regard to where this transformation is going. What I found out was very sad. Because I even organized a conference in Hong Kong. I invited a lot of people to talk about their own cities. Whatever they talk about, I can know from America. Because they didn't have any voice of their own. Right? And then I investigated how come. Right? So they have a focus. And they have a framework. And they have a vantage point. Three important things in research, which a lot of researchers don't talk about, doesn't help them, right? In regard to the focus, they focus 60% of the, I just checked the literature, 60% of the literature focus on the central business district. Central business district is something that the Western people understand. When they go around, I'm also westernized people like us, when we walk around, we see central businesses, hey, Pudong, Bandra Kurla, fantastic, right? And then the second one, about 30% is about the slum. That's the opposite of the Western developed city, right? It used to be more than 30%, but now it's 30% because many business districts are developing. 10% is about the heritage history. That's Hegel's idea that Asia is caught in history, you know, and we are modernizing, we are transforming. We had the Industrial Revolution and that kind of stuff. So very much caught up in, we understand the non-Western city from in regard to the Western city. It's something that urbanists are trapped in, and I don't know how to do that either. But I can see something that's huge transformation happening in Asian cities. I see the need to understand. And somebody from here, from Singapore, Lu Thai Ker, he used to be the planner of this city when it transformed from a third world place to whatever it is now. And he was very clear about this. Right now, the spatial is following the social in Asia because we don't have any social concept of where it's going. So people keep building and so on, and then the planners try to accommodate that. Now, if we go like this, at some point, it'll be very expensive. We will need to plan the second round, as he calls it. If we plan that, it'll be very expensive because the real estate will be very high at that time. And also, we will have to move people, right? So we are actually moving into some sort of a disaster. We need to figure out where we are going so that we can be a little bit proactive. Which I don't see any, but I'm looking for, right? But the issue with this academically is we need to look at the right places. If you're looking at the three that I talked about, we will not find any responses to our question. We need to use frameworks. If we use Marxist framework, we will see class. If we use gender framework, we will see gender, you know, like and so on. If we use feminist frameworks, and so on. So we need to theorize from. And number three is we need to look at urbanization and the larger world from Asia. We cannot look at Asia from the West because that's what has happened. Because of that, Asia has become a database for Western theories. So a lot of people, you know, like we do jobs for the United Nations, this, that, and these researchers. There's a lot of studies
But it's all data.
Because we don't question what is democracy. Is that even important, right? And so on. So the brown people have just moved into white spaces, and they think, you know, Sri Lanka is very well known for this Ceylon. They say Ceylonese people in the early 20th century, they were so much into out English in the English. Because one has to understand, there's no way to understand Asia from a non-nation standpoint.
Well, I think that's really fascinating. Probably we will end here, but just some closing remarks on how you mentioned how important it is in terms of epistemology, in terms of ideas, and then how that impacts the material conditions, and how perhaps it's good to proactively think about these places rather than simply academia describing material conditions as we see it. And then also your comment on how important it is to think from a place and as part of maybe a broader project of decolonization, although I'm not sure you subscribe to some of these bigger terms. Anyway, thank you, Professor Nihal Pereira, for sharing your insights.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You are listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, please visit us on isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates through social media. We are on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.